Welcome to East Meets West, episode 69.
69, or is it?
Or is it what? What did I just say?
All right.
We need to come up with some sort of regular, like, snappy intro or tagline or something.
Where the beer is cold and the women are hot.
Except it's not true.
It's
but
true.
It could work. You know, you remember I was talking about the whole Stargate, getting Stargate on the web thing?
Yeah.
Well, I finally had to give up for seasons 9 of SG-1 and season 2 of Atlantis and just get it by Netflix.
Why?
Because I stopped being able to find any of the episodes. Everybody kept getting pulled down off YouTube and everything. So I finally did Netflix, and then I purchased season passes to iTunes. So I've been watching them on my iPod. And you know what? It's cool because without having to slave away downloading something and converting it and everything, I just watch it on the bus.
I don't know. I tried watching stuff on my iPod, and it's just really hard after a while on your eyes, on my eyes.
You know, it's great though. I'm watching on the bus. I pause, go inside, sync. And then I can finish watching on the big screen through the Apple TV.
I've watched most of the new ones already. So.
Yeah, well, but I'm just saying the TV watching experience is pretty good. I might go watch Eureka now because I like that show.
You do?
Yeah.
It's kind of hit and miss for me.
I haven't seen all the episodes, though, so I can catch up.
So in other words, you watched one and you like it.
No, I watched like 3.
Right.
Man.
I'm just grumpy today.
You are the grump. You're like the French.
The French?
Yeah.
Yeah, they picked up a new Napoleon. Actually, he's not Napoleon. He's
President Sarkozy.
Is that how you start? Sarkozy?
I don't know. Probably way up.
Sarkozy?
Sarkozy.
He's the son of a Hungarian, not diplomat, but a Hungarian immigrant into France. So
I kind of like what he did with his cabinet. You know, the new handles, repainted them.
Oh, put new shelf paper in there.
Yeah, he's got those more ergonomic interiors. No, I mean, he appointed 7 women. He's making a big deal.
Bernard Kouchner.
Bernard Kouchner is not one of the 7 women.
No, I thought you meant, like, his new cabinet.
Yeah, but I just said...
Oh, I'm sorry.
I just said he appointed 7 women.
All right.
But yes, Bernard Kouchner is one of the more controversial picks, correct?
Yes. I think the socialists don't like him because he turned to the other side, and the conservatives don't like him because he has a very liberal streak in him still.
Now, you're saying you thought you read that he's anti-American. I thought I read that he's pro-American. Not that it really matters.
No, I know Nicholas is pro-American, but...
Yeah, but what's his name was? Mr. Kouchner has served in socialist governments... Because I read the same story you did. That's what's funny about it.
A pro-European, Mr. Kouchner was one of the few freshmen to support the invasion of Iraq, though he fiercely criticized American management aftermath. He will be complimented by the expected return of Jean-David.
Okay, go down to the box that says key cabinet posts in the BBC story.
Oh, I'm going to The Economist.
Oh, okay. And that next to the box that says, but Mr. Kouchner's pro-American line should fit in well with Mr. Sarkozy's thinking. The BBC's Carolyn Wyatt reports.
Key cabinet post, prime minister.
Yeah, so if you go to the left of that, the paragraph that starts, but Mr. Kouchner. See, they call it pro-American.
He's one of the few French politicians former social cohesion minister.
Well, you know, it's France.
Minister Jean-Louis Borloo will manage the economy, employment, and Prime Minister's Fillon's team. It would be interesting.
Kouchner founded Doctors Without Borders, correct?
Yeah, Medicine.
Medicine Sans Frontières.
No, somewhere I don't know. So I read somewhere that was a pro-profit group.
Oh, is it?
But I don't know because
it's Doctors Without Borders, not Doctors Without Bank Accounts.
Yeah, it's a whole different thing. Everyone shows up there in their own private yacht.
That's how you get across the border in your nice new limo.
Well, you know, France has a, especially compared to its neighbors, has an endemic cycle of unemployment that has been stubbornly high, even compared to Germany, who was before the torchbearer in unemployment. I think these are fracking
up. What, your headphones are fracking up with you?
Yeah, they just keep kind of distorting every time I talk, so I think it's me talking to them.
We are, and I guess this is an inopportune time to point it out, but...
Go ahead.
We are recording at CNET.
Oh. All right. Mystery's destroyed. Everyone's seen the man behind the curtain.
Well, I'm supposed to say that I'm supposed to
promote. Brought to you by CNET.
Because I have approval to do it now. We're not sneaking around it.
All right. But, it's,
Were you trying to stop me from saying that, or did you think I was going to say something else?
I was going to stop you from saying that.
Oh, we can take it out.
Whatever. No matter. It's been done. Let it be done. Let it be recorded and done.
We've recorded at Ziff Davis before.
It's true. Twice.
Was I not supposed to say that?
No, once. That's when we've done it once.
Am I not supposed to say that either?
I don't mind.
Yeah.
Just here.
We've jumped the shark.
Oh, I'm
right
sorry.
Right there.
All right. Go back on track. So Germany used to be the standard bearer for unemployment and industrial laggardness. But now, through reforms put in, the economy has been picking up again. Productivity has increased. Sense of optimism. Sarkozy hopes to do that and actually using a bit of the Anglo style of business management, basically a lot less state, coercion and state, manipulation in the economy.
I think this could be a very good thing for France.
Oh no, it has to be because currently in their current trends, they're not going to.
They're so green and muppety.
Yes, Kermit. That was totally a Freudian slip. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah. Never mind. We'll just let you make the pun yourself at home.
France is the way it is. There's just not enough work. I mean, when what? A quarter of young people are unemployed? That's a lot. That's
yeah, but they have public assistance, so.
Yes, because nothing cures unemployment like public assistance.
Yeah, but it keeps you fed.
It's true, but at some point, someone has to make money to pay into the public welfare coffers.
The other 75% of young people are doing that.
Maybe.
What, does everybody have to do it?
Yeah, generally.
Then there's no need for public assistance if everybody has a job.
Huh. Imagine that.
Jeez, Roger. Don't you know how the economy works?
Don't you know how a welfare state subsists other people?
What do you think of the Cato Institute?
Cato? Is that like is that like Green Hornet's new think tank?
No, it's a libertarian thing.
Is it libertarian?
It's fairly libertarian, yeah. I don't think they're like Libertarian Party libertarian, but they're all free market and stuff.
So, but why do you bring it up?
Well, it just bringing up the whole like economy and public institutions and
I'm kind of mixed on that whole thing, but I generally agree that the less government interferes in things, generally things work out a little better. I understand the need for things like a centralized a system for maintaining a fair economy. In other words, you have courts of arbitration to prevent monopolies, to prevent people from manipulating markets to their own advantage. At the same time, I don't believe that, and I also believe that, incentives for companies and, not in the sense of tax breaks, but in the sense of, schooling, education to give you, a good talent pool to work from.
Right.
As well as
public,
open
in
markets.
Other words, public support of education in order to provide an educated and talented workforce.
But at the same time, I'm against subsidies, like agricultural subsidies. And I'm not against, giving out, especially in hard times, but I'm just hand over fist corporate.
Price supports, I think, is what you're saying.
Well, that, because I also wanted to segue that into, just standard commerce where, what people often, derisively term as corporate welfare.
Although there's a good argument, I think, to be made for just basically security in making sure your food supply can come from your own land. If you become dependent on overseas food supply, then what if that country turns against you? I mean, weakens your security a bit, don't you think?
It sounds good. It's a very specious argument, and the reason why I say that is that we don't get our bulk of our food from one country in the same way that we get a bulk of our petroleum resources from a select group of nations.
But what if we anger everyone?
You know what? It doesn't matter because they still want to make money.
Right, but what if they just get really mad?
Hey, you know why sanctions don't work? Because there's someone out there who's willing to sell it.
Yeah, well, that's very true. We've seen that in action.
And the thing is, as long as everyone's commit is everyone, as long as everyone's dependent on like, and that was the whole point of free trade, was by making countries dependent their welfare dependent on someone else's welfare, it would generally lead to less aggressive actions by one state against another, because, you know, everything's connected, you know, the whole kind of web. One person's, you know, derives their power source from one country, and they in turn depend on finished products, medicines, or food, agriculture stuff. So, and that's the weird thing is, like, price supports have actually skewed the market in favor of rich countries versus poor countries. You know, for example, subsidized wheat, subsidized soy, subsidized corn. In Europe, it's worse. In Japan, I mean, you can't three peaches, $5.
Yeah, because they can't grow them themselves.
They can't grow it, but they have high tariffs for imported produce.
Yeah, and it also costs a lot to begin with to ship something over there. So when you add an export tariff,
but you
and
know
you add an import tariff.
Yeah,
and you add, you know, price supports on the internal produce. Man, yeah.
Well, the thing is, shipping may or may not increase, but I mean,
it does.
I use this argument. If that is true, then why do the price of consumer goods that we purchase overseas are cheaper than they were? You know, think about all the electronics you buy. Where are they made?
Right. No. They're made overseas. For
yes,
the most part,
and they're
right.
Shipped over here.
Yes.
Yet. If you look historically on the scale, I mean, even accounting for inflation, they're a lot cheaper than they were 5 years ago.
Yeah, but I think that's a separate trend. I think that is an economy of efficiency and scale. I mean, I think,
and you cannot do the same thing with agriculture.
Well, because of no, actually, I think the agricultural market.
There's actually a glut of wheat. That's why wheat is priced so low.
Yeah, but here's my counterexample. In Hawaii,
uh-huh.
which is part of the United States,
yes,
all the stuff coming from the mainland is more expensive. Even though there's no tariff, there's no price supports. I mean, you know, in other words, there's no penalty for shipping something to Hawaii. It just costs a lot to get it over there.
Compared to people on the mainland, that is true. But compared relatively historically for the same products in that same area, have they not been cheaper than, you know, or even available than like 100 years ago?
I think food's pretty cheap these days. It's real cheap.
just the way you say that. Real,
real cheap. Tawdry even. You know, a couple of peaches were giving me the eye the other day.
Yeah, and so, you know, it's hard to say, but, you know, I mean, even countries like India and Brazil have their own tariffs, and which is why I think that their arguments, the whole G20 thing, is somewhat kind of hypocritical, because they're demanding advanced industrial nations pull down tariffs and open up their markets to their products, but they won't do the same in return.
Right. Everybody's still protectionist to
a
certain extent.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. So, and that's why things like the Doha Round and what was that in the upcoming G8? Or is that the G8 summit out in Germany that's coming up?
Yeah.
That's why they're so hard, because everyone's really kind of, you know, all politics is local. You know, you don't want to upset the populace. And that's why the French have been really good at that.
I don't think an open market is necessarily the salve that solves all ills.
No.
But let me say what I'm going to say. I do think that we are not going to learn what we need to do to correct the problems of a free and open market until we actually get one. And we have small ones in localized areas. But until we really finally move out of that mercantilist way of thought totally for good, then I think we start to actually see what needs to be fixed. I think it's still obfuscated right now because there is no pure capitalist system anywhere.
Exactly.
On Earth.
In the same way that people, and it's kind of funny because people say, well, you know, true socialism has never worked because, you know, the Soviet
Union, one ever did it.
It's in the same way. I mean, the thing is that
I'd argue against that. I think some of the Scandinavian countries have gotten pretty close to a true socialism and made it work okay.
Yeah, but
but
see, that depends on how you describe socialism. They still respect private property,
right? And
you have property rights.
There's no reason for socialism not to respect private property.
You're talking
about communism.
But
yes.
see, that's the thing right there. Oftentimes, you know, whether or not it's intentionally done so, it's always mixed together.
Yeah, communism has never been done in a pure way either.
No.
But I also think there's some pretty serious issues with that because it takes too much central planning.
Well, it's not only central planning, but, you know, like all systems, you're working with the basis of human fallibility, right? When the central planning decreed that the late, what's that great inland sea that was in the Soviet, like in Armenia or bordering or Azerbaijan?
You're talking about the Baltic Sea? Or?
No, it starts with an A. They basically, now it's like so low because they diverted the waters from it to grow cotton, which,
oh, okay,
you
know, yeah, I don't remember the name of it.
The Akale Sea or AK?
Akkadian?
No, it's like AKA something.
Mm-hmm.
But literally that whole sea is shrunk by 50% because of all the diverted water.
An inconvenient truth.
And the thing is, like, the reason why they did it, it never panned out anyway, was to grow, it was basically make them quote-unquote self-sufficient in basic products like cotton and wheat, which they weren't. So, you know, it's, you know, it, there's nothing, to, you know, it's, you know, I agree
Aral,
in some.
The Aral Sea?
That's it.
Okay. Looked it up.
You and your magic toys. But it's weird. And the thing is, like, you know, people are anti-globalization. I don't really think they understand in those terms. Are they talking against basically a corporate oligarchy where, you know, large corp, like a few select huge conglomerates run everything? Yeah, that I'm totally against.
Yeah, because that's an artificial concentration.
Exactly,
of power.
And that's the thing is, I believe in free movement of capital, and if that happens, you will come to an equilibrium. You won't come to the most ideal one because an ideal is always something that you'll never reach. Because
the big problem with capitalism is it sounds very good until you get to the part about people having to be efficient and finding the, you know, what people aren't smart when they shop.
Yeah.
And so you don't force the efficiencies in the marketplace that capitalism could if everybody was playing by the rules. If everybody went for the best bargain all the time.
Yeah. And that goes back to, you know, to vested interests, right? Whether it's a federal, state, local, or even like, you know, say a school board. Yeah, we're going to go with this guy because, you know, he's my wife's, you know, he's my brother-in-law, so we should buy from him.
Yeah, I know if I, you know, shopped around, I could probably find this thing for about $50 less, but I'm just tired.
Yeah. Well, no, but see,
I'm dazzled by the lights.
But see, for that, like, for me, convenience trumps a certain price advantage, right?
And that could be considered to be just part of the whole economic circumstance.
For example, one of the things that recent growers have been doing, you know,
ignorance gets in there too, not just convenience.
Yeah. Oh, no, totally. I'm not saying that's all convenience, but in certain circumstances, convenience does come into play, right? I mean, isn't that why you order takeout?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and you'll pay a little more for it.
Right? Isn't that why most clothes are off the rack?
But what if there is another takeout place that would be better food and cheaper, but you won't try it because it's new? I mean, and there's
that's still part of the capitalism. That means you need to get. I mean, if you had a new restaurant, right, and you did the best takeout and you had the cheapest prices, really convenient, but you didn't have a sign, you didn't have a storefront, you didn't tell anyone.
Yeah, but I'm not saying that. I'm saying in the responsibility of the consumer, sometimes the consumer isn't efficient.
But see, at the end, who suffers the most? The consumer, right? You're spending.
No, not necessarily.
You don't think?
No, because we fool ourselves. What rewards us isn't always getting the best bargain.
Yeah, but
what rewards us are things that are totally unrelated to the economy.
But see, that's the thing, though. Are you assuming that everyone thinks like? Some people may not. Some people will, some people won't.
Yeah, but there's also the...
As much as I hate marketing speak, that's where the whole marketing comes in.
The issue... Well, and then the marketing is a whole different thing about skewing things so that people don't know what they're getting and feel constantly...
It can be. Not always it can be.
Feel constantly ripped off because they're constantly being promised something that they don't get. And they learn not to even trust marketing anymore. I think we're getting to that point in a certain way. But people still fall for it. And that's one of those inefficiencies in the marketplace where crappy products can become the dominant product because of good marketing.
But see, that's the thing, though. That's the part of human nature that you...
But it leads to a poorer quality of life.
Maybe, maybe not.
No,
it depends.
I think it does.
You think?
And I can't show it right now, but I think...
I think that's a very anecdotal and a very kind of like gut feeling, but You know,
humans are inefficient, and we don't always know how to relate the consequences of our actions to its consequences, and that's the failing of capitalism.
But you know what? That happens with everything. I mean, that's what we call evolution, right?
Oh, yeah.
The ones that don't get to breed are the ones that fall off the cliff early.
I'm just saying that's the fault there. That would be the thing that...
That's the entropy, though. That's what makes life interesting.
I'm not saying it isn't interesting. I'm saying that's one of the weaknesses in having 100% faith in it as a system.
No, I don't have 100%.
No, I'm not talking about you.
I understand, but in the same way that Winston Churchill said that democracy is one of the most foul means of government around,
but
if it weren't for the fact that everything else, you know, was worse.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, yeah, and that's my take is, yeah.
Well, and that's why I brought up the Cato Institute, because their slogan, individual liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace.
But my question is
that goes right along
I don't disagree, but my question is, what brought you to the Cato? I mean, was there a story or was there a concept?
Yeah, there was. What was it? There was a story this week about the Copyright Institute being started in Washington, D.C. by a bunch of big media companies to really promote the use of copyright law to protect innovation and creative rights. And one of the people named to the board was a big free market libertarian. And I just found that really unusual to see a free market libertarian pushing for government intervention.
Yeah.
And there was something in the article that mentioned how the Cato Institute differed from this guy. And so that's the thing that put it into my mind, because I think they had a different take, and I haven't found out what it is, frankly. But
yeah, you know, the whole thing is copyright and patents have gotten to absurd proportions. And the thing is, yeah, you know, I understand the importance of copyright, and I respect an original author, original work.
Certainly.
But
I don't think anybody's – well, some people maybe, but I'm not.
For example, I am not one to – like, if I find music I like, I will eventually buy the CD. Not maybe that week, but, you know, a few months, I bought my last 12 CDs that way. You know, found music I found mainly through internet radio. It's like, hey, that sounds really good. I've heard, like, a few songs. I'm going to buy it. But what I don't like are – and this actually skews both ways. I don't like heavy-handed kind of corporate mentalities. Like, okay, we're going to put all these locks and we're going to sue every little one. On the flip side, I don't like people say, yeah, I'm just going to rip everything and make it for free and kind of, you know, like basically, you know, pirating software.
But I believe we've got copyright laws that are sufficient right now. I think what they're doing with digital rights management and lockouts and all of that is only hurting them. They're starting to realize it. They're coming around to it. And I think copyright law and how they go out and they do try to sue people, I think they're doing a really poor job of targeting. But I think the idea of, like, if you massively distribute copyrighted material, we're going to get you. I think that is the way the system's supposed to work. I don't think we need additional law.
It's because a lot of those, like, record companies, if you really pull everything back and you look at it, they're just middlemen.
Yeah.
They don't create the music.
And they know that position as middleman is threatened.
Yeah, it's the same thing between, you know, right?
It's not going to get killed. It's not going to go away, but it's going to become less profitable.
And in many ways, you know, I hope, like, for example, why is there only ASCAP and BMI?
Oh, that goes back to the 50s.
But there was
a settlement.
But you see what I'm saying, right? And we're left with a lot of this legacy.
Well, there's only Sound Exchange. There's not even two. There's only Sound Exchange for online radio.
So
online radio.
So yeah,
Let's fit in a couple comments here before we go. Oliver W. Kim says, "Roger, the godlike characters in Tolkien's mythos were called the Valar.
Yes,
and their lower angelic servants were called the Maiar.
No, that's actually because the Valar weren't gods; they were just higher orders of the Maiar.
Well, there was a Iluvatar. Iluvatar was the god.
Yeah, it was the supreme being, and the Valar were essentially the Maiar that were like." The high end, right? You have the high end, the low end.
Morgoth was one of the chief Valar, and Gandalf, Saruman, and Sauron were all Maiar.
Yep. So, and Morgoth was, in many ways, if you think about it, was kind of Tolkien's Satan, right?
Yeah.
The high order angel that
Oliver actually says Tolkien's mythology was heavily based on Norse mythology. Loki as Morgoth, Odin as Marve.
But he mixed in both you know, Christianity as well as Nordic.
Definitely.
And a few Germanic influences.
And even a little bit of Greek.
Yeah.
I mean, in the hero archetypes and stuff.
But yeah, I mean, he drew from a very rich source of material. And, you know, it shows because, you know, most people that have attempted to do anything similar have generally come up with, you know, initially very interesting characters, but they don't really have a very big depth to them, and that's one of the things that Tolkien did very well. He created, you know, he created the language, he created the history that make it so enjoyable.
I think people don't realize just how incredible it is what he did, because when you start to dig into it, you realize just how thick the mythology he created was.
But that was his goal. He wanted to create a new mythology
and a language.
I mean, you know,
it's actually more than one language.
And this is from one guy. I mean, like, if you think about it, the whole Klingon dictionary is written by, you know, one person who was not associated with the original Star Trek series.
Yeah.
So, you know,
Star Trek starts to approach the breadth of the Tolkien universe, but think about how many different people it has taken
exactly.
to create that.
And in some respects, it's still relatively shallow.
Yeah.
In many places. So, yeah, I mean, he spent a lot of time on it.
Let's fit in one more from Josh Holloway. This is pretty much nothing to do with anything you guys have previously talked about on the podcast, but it's very late, and I feel like posting this somewhere. East meets West seemed as appropriate a place as any. Wouldn't time travel, at least the kind we see in popular fiction, be deemed impossible simply due to the first law of thermodynamics? If the total energy of the universe is a constant, how could you possibly introduce something out of nowhere, a.k.a. DMC DeLorean, into a past universe to throw off that constant? I know I can't be the first to think of this, but I'm surprised I haven't heard it before.
But, I mean, that's also supposing, you know, you take the point of view that time is linear. Right? Time is...
Yeah, I think the easy way around that, right, is to say that the first law of thermodynamics applies to all distances and all time.
Yeah. I mean,
so when you move something in time, you're not violating the law of thermodynamics because it spans all of time.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean it depends on, you know, how you quantify time. In fact, we had... didn't we get one follow-up to that guy at the end? Why am I at... isn't that space-time continuum? I think... 19. At Holloway. I'm thinking the DeLorean was temporarily displaced, but the mass energy of the universe remains constant.
So it's no more would violate the first law of thermodynamics than me getting up and walking across
exactly.
the room. Because I've changed positions in space.
Yes.
And time travel, you've changed position in space-time. And it is a continuum.
Exactly.
Ha-ha! There's got to be a problem with that. I'm sure somebody will point
it
out.
I don't know. We could do the Star Trek thing and come in with the Heisenberg compensator.
Heisenberg compensator. Well, then there's that. There's the quantum effect that, you know, matter and energy are being constantly created and destroyed.
Well, I mean, well, that's...
Bunnies made of cheese.
Well, I mean, like, you know, if you take it to extreme, everything's energy, right? Even mass. I mean, that's where the whole E equals MC squared.
And then there's dark energy.
Yes, dark energy.
And dark energy halos.
You know, the more I read about, used to read about superstring and the whole kind of...
Dark energy is not part of string theory.
No, but string theory and all and all the other adjacent kind of quantum theories and stuff. The more and more it seems really kind of like a freaking religion because everyone kind of takes these sides.
Yeah.
And, you know...
That's always, science has always been like that.
Though. And in many ways, you know, you have your evangelist. You have your evangelical researcher. This is the way it is, if you can't see.
I'll tell you what, because when I read about dark energy, and they're like, well, we couldn't get the equations to come out right on the expansion of the universe, and we had these anomalies in the earlier part of the universe, and then expansion seemed to accelerate, slowed down, and then we came up with dark energy, and so now we're just looking for confirmation of our theories with dark energy. Doesn't it remind you of the ether?
Yes. And in fact, it's funny because... that's how mystics and people might laugh at superstition and folklore, but a lot of that.
But the ether wasn't even superstition. It was this reputable scientist were saying there's this ether and light travels through the ether.
Well, but you see what I'm saying is that like in all those instances, they came up with the best explanation they knew of from their
and
understanding.
And they were even testing to try to find evidence of the ether during the. During the trip to the moon. And I mean, they were going to, right? Until Einstein came along in the early part of the 1900s. When I said the trip to the moon, it was a plausible trip to the moon at that point. They obviously didn't know how to send somebody. Einstein came along with the theory of relativity, the general and special theories, and just blew away the ether. And they gave up. I'm wondering if we're going to see that happen with dark energy and dark matter. Are we going to see somebody come along and come up with that kind of breakthrough that just blows it all away with something totally new?
But see, that's the thing for me with science is like, you know, I like science. I like scientific things. But in many ways, it is its own religion at this point because many people have placed specific faith.
Now you're starting to sound like a creationist.
I'm telling you.
You're a creationist?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm just – but you know what? You laugh, but you know it's a very fine line in certain circumstances.
Well, I agree with you to a point, which is when you get to defining – if you define religion as a way of explaining the unexplainable without – you know, much proof.
No.
Science plays in that area.
That is just one facet of religion. I mean, that's one facet of what religion does for a society or for a group of people. But, I mean, like, didn't the string theory already fall out of favor?
It has fallen somewhat out of favor. It's like, not totally given up. But, you know, I mean, that's different than religion. We're not talking – there is definitely a matter of faith in theories and that they're going to prove true. But that's different than setting it up and saying don't ever question it. And that's what you have to do in a religion.
But you have to set something up and say
don't ever question. There's always one fundamental truth in a religion that is unquestionable. In science, nothing is ever unquestionable. But isn't that why we have
physical laws, right? The law of thermodynamics that can never be broken.
Well, we have proven that law.
We have proven up to our ability to test it.
Yeah, but that's different than saying, I got no proof for the virgin birth, but you're just going to believe it because it's our religion and you're not going to question it. So people are free to question the first law of thermodynamics if they can prove that it's wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not set up as a holy thing that you can't question. But
that's the thing is, you know, you used to be able to question a lot of things. You used to be questioned, you know, even in faith you could question. I mean, recently that's been more of a taboo, like you can't, you know, do...
When were you ever in a religion allowed to question certain tenets?
I mean, isn't that why you had the Reformation in the church? You had a bunch of...
Yeah, but even in Martin Luther's time, there were certain things that no one was
allowed
to question.
I mean, even after that...
Like the Holy Spirit and the existence of God. You couldn't be in the religion if you didn't believe in God. I mean, it comes down to that. So that's what I mean. There's always at least one thing that just, you know, you can't say, well, I think I'm Lutheran, but I don't believe in the whole God thing. It just doesn't work.
I don't know. Maybe you'll see a sect that comes out and that does just that. I mean,
well, they're called atheists.
I don't know. See, that's I don't
atheist Lutherans.
I don't believe in atheists. Yeah, I
don't.
I don't believe you're an atheist. I don't believe.
We got to save that for another podcast. All right. That's a good discussion. We should definitely have. I don't know. Will we be doing one a week from now, or are we going to have to take another week off? We might have to.
We might, but I don't know, so we'll play it by ear.
Okay, just watch the blog, sobrilliant.com/EMW. Talk to you later.
Bye.
So, Roger?
Yes.
There will be no jokes about the episode number on this episode.
We're at 67?
69.